This is the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding people better. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. In this episode, I talked to race car driver Andy Lally. Andy has raced just about every kind of car out there, but his specialty the last 20 years has been what's called endurance sports car racing. These are very long races, sometimes up to 24 hours long. For the last 12 years, he's been a member of Magnus Racing, which is a GT racing team. And GT stands for Gran Turismo, also known as Grand Touring. It basically means sports car racing. Topics I talk about with Andy include, how much does randomness and chance play a role in race car driving versus skill? What are the factors and sources of advantage when you're trying to pass other drivers or trying to prevent them from passing? What's the boundary between acceptable behavior when racing versus what's considered too aggressive and dangerous? What are some examples of interesting spots Andy's been in where he was proud of the decisions he made? What's it like being a vegan in an industry where that's a pretty rare thing? You can follow Andy on Twitter at Andy Lally, that's Andy, L-A-L-L-Y, or on Instagram at Andy Lally Racing. If you're hearing this, you're listening to the free version of the podcast. If you've enjoyed this podcast and what I'm trying to do with it, would you be willing to show your support by signing up for a paid premium subscription? It's currently $50 per year. You get a few benefits like ad-free episodes and the chance to collaborate and give me question ideas for upcoming interviews. But most importantly, you'd be helping me make the podcast better, encouraging me to spend more time on it, and helping me promote it. To sign up for that, go to my website, behavior-podcast.com. I want to give a thanks to my friend Jimmy Latham, who gave me the idea to interview a race car driver, and who gave me some ideas for some questions based on his own experience in motocross racing. Okay, here's the talk with Andy Lally. I'm going to cut to a part of our talk where I'm asking him about the nature of endurance racing. And when you said endurance, when you said that was part of your specialty, what does the endurance part mean? Does that just mean really long races, or?
It means really long races. So, like your longest race in IndyCars is 500 miles. And it's usually a mileage marker in those races like that. So in IndyCars, it's 500 miles. NASCAR is a lot of 500 mile races, and then they have one 600 mile race. And in endurance sports car racing, your longest race is 24 hours. So you will literally throw the green flag at noon on Saturday and throw the checkered flag on noon on Sunday. And who's ever got the most laps at that point is the winner. And oftentimes now in the last two decades, but for sure the last decade and a half or so, the cars are so good and the teams are so competitive that over 24 hours, you have multiple cars on the same lap. So your timing and scoring, your racing and your strategy to get every last little fraction of a second out of what you're doing is of the utmost importance. And like this year, our biggest race is the 24 hours of Daytona. We just had that race last month, and we finished second in it by 5 seconds. So imagine a 24-hour long race.
Oh my
that
God.
The winner is just 5 seconds behind you. And third place was just about 6 or 7 seconds behind us. So it was a very, very close event where even one little bobble on any of those laps could have cost us everything.
Yeah, it's like a soccer game. Super long, yes. Very close.
Yeah. It's like a super long soccer game, yes. So that's our longest race of the year. We do 12-hour races, 10-hour races, 6-hour races, and then we have what we would call a sprint race, which is 3 hours long and on other occasions as well.
So maybe that's a good segue, because one of the things I'm generally curious about when it comes to any sport or game is how much of an edge you can get. So let's say there's a race with a bunch of drivers who are good but not great, and there's a driver in there who's great, and everyone has the exact same car and same pit crew. How often is that great driver winning? Are they gonna win like all the time? How much is luck and random chance going to play a role there? How do you see that?
If you truly have a race where you have one excellent driver and let's say 20 mediocre drivers, and it is a long enough race, and you have what you say is all equal cars and all equal pit crews and all that stuff. Most of the time, somebody that's a far superior driver is going to come through with something like that. And the cars are never equal, and the pit crews are never equal, and your situations are never equal. So that's what makes the racing part of that exciting. On top of that, you're not going to get a situation and on the top level where you have such a dominant driver. Everybody that's at the peak of all of the top, in a feeder series or up and coming races, you'll get some standouts that are on their way up to be at the top level, that sort of destroy the field, and the rungs of the ladder as they come through. But those drivers, most of the time, will make it or at least have a shot at the top. But there's so many other things that come into play that determine how and when they get their opportunity.
Right. Like you say, it's the longer the race is, the less luck or chance would play a role. So I imagine the longer the race is, the better you feel about winning it, kind of. Would you say that's true?
Sort of. I mean, it really, so it depends. If you're driving at an absolute limit, you're going to find an edge. And then a lot of, it's especially a young driver coming up, or anybody under any pressure, you're trying to find that edge to drive the car as fast as you can. When you go over that edge, depending on where it happens on the track, it could either be a small mistake that gets corrected or a catastrophic mistake that totals the car. So, any and everything in between there can take place. And that's where the art of doing what we do comes into play.
Right. There's different considerations. Yeah. You're taking more risks maybe in shorter races and such.
Right. Yeah. And that's honestly the psychological part of that comes into play massively, being able to, and I'll use the term bandwidth probably a handful of times in this conversation, but so you've got 100% bandwidth that you're working with, and regardless of how big that bandwidth is, there's some drivers are going to be smarter and quicker and more reacting than others, but you're working with 100% of your bandwidth. How much of that focus do you basically give to different portions of what you think is important? And in some of those cases, the thought process of how and why do I need to go any faster at this moment? If you can be out front and be in control, is it a waste to win the race by like a mile, or do you chill out a little bit, have the confidence that you've got a decent piece under you, and you drive at 99% instead of 101%? And that is a huge factor in how you deal with other variables that are thrown at you during the race.
Yeah, it seems like constant risk management, ongoing risk management. Yeah,
risk management is an excellent term, excellent way to put it. Yeah.
So how important? I've always been curious. How important is that initial starting position? Because I understand there's some kind of like contest, and then you get placed based on that. But how big a role does that starting position play?
The longer the race, the less important. There are some sprint races, and depending on different kinds of racing, it's everything. You're not going to make up enough time to win or whatnot. But like, in a 24-hour race, I've started last and won before. But in if you're starting even just a 2-hour race and you start last, it really does put you behind the eight ball. The other factor that comes into play is the track itself. In NASCAR, the biggest track that they race on is Talladega. You can start last there, and as long as you're not caught up in a wreck in that duration of time, a 500-mile race, it would be much easier to work forward than at a tight, twisty street circuit or something like if we were doing the Chicago race, which is coming up in this summer on the NASCAR side. Much, much more difficult to work through, and much more risk and more potential for danger and damage for sure by starting in the back.
So let's get into, we can get into some of the more psychology and behavior related questions. Are there certain behaviors that opponent drivers can have that can change the decisions that you make, for example, like spots where you get a sense of what a driver is going to do based on the way they're driving and kind of like a tell, a read, things like that come to mind?
So I will race different drivers in different ways. It won't be a massive difference, but it will be things that I would take into consideration are the history of that driver, how clean he is, how smooth he is, how consistent he is or she, and how likely they are to fold under pressure. That pressure also will be higher and lower at different points of the race. You know, if it's the end of the race, the pressure is really high. If it's the beginning of the race, the pressure might not be as high unless, you know, there's that kind of driver that is easily coaxed into making a mistake. and you can try and do that. So there's, and then also it gets personal often. And if there's a history of, if there's bad blood between two drivers, then if there's bad blood between myself and another driver and it's coming down to a corner that we're approaching at 180 miles an hour and something potentially dangerous is at hand, I care less about people that I'm not friends with and the situation that they may be in, both for their team's financial disregard of what they would have to repair in the near future and the potential health of the driver. You know, you never want to see anybody get badly hurt, sometimes you don't mind sending a message also.
So when you talk about the, putting pressure on other drivers and them making mistakes based on that, like what kind of scenarios are we talking? Is that like, how you drive up behind them, how you try to pass them? Like what are the most important situations that come to mind for that?
So it's a high speed chess game. And so you are trying to position yourself on the part of the track that is going to give you the best arc through the corner. And then in addition to that, there's a ton of little subjects that you would pay attention to per corner, where why you would adjust that arc and adjust what you're doing, not only for track conditions, but weather conditions. And then on top of that, other variables that come into play, which is who's in front of you and who's behind you and where they're going. So your strategy can adjust nonstop depending on what they're doing. And it can very much change last second, depending on what you're seeing both out your windshield and in your rearview mirror. So yes, I would position, there's times where I would position myself behind a driver in a certain way to either get their attention, distract them, or make them think I'm going to do something that I'm not, to get them to respond in a way that I want them to, so that I can do the thing that I want them, that I want to do, to get by, essentially.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the reverse trickery kind of aspect, like where a driver, like you're saying, pretend you're going one way and go the other. Is that pretty common? Like, is everyone doing things like that, or is it often more simple than that?
There's usually only so many things you can do, and you have to be, you're constantly in trajectory change. You know, even if you're going in a straight line, you're planning on the next trajectory change. And sometimes that will be in response to where the other person is. And so there's a pretty easily perceived, how do I put this best? It's pretty easy to perceive who has the advantage in the corner, of coming to the corner, and that's just in who's gaining and who's losing to who. And the moves are relatively, it's not like there's a million moves to do. There's only a handful of moves to do. And it's usually pretty easy to guess, 90% of the time what's going to happen next. But sometimes you can force a hand where even if you know what's going to happen, you have to play that, just like a chess move or something like that. And you might sacrifice a pawn for a rook. And so it's one of those games where you're constantly trying to think through not only just how to get by the next guy or how to keep the next guy back. Sometimes there's a coexistence that has to happen where you're trying to get that person by without losing a half a second. You're trying to lose like a tenth of a second instead of going through a corner side by side. So you might actually help a pass happen, because if I'm in fifth and the guy behind me in sixth is so obviously coming, and if I cause a fight, it's going to slow us both down a little bit, and then seventh place is going to get me. But if it's the last lap and I see that the sixth place car is coming and I'm in fifth, and it's like, well, I'd rather finish sixth than seventh, and this guy's either going to move me out of the way by pushing me, or if I fight it so much, we're going to go side by side through the corner, not be at our optimal speed, and the seventh place car is going to get a run. So there's lots of different reasons, and that's where that bandwidth comes into play. You've got to be able to one reason with a, and you have to be efficient at the bandwidth that you've allotted for your reason, and then for your aggression, and then for your precision. And then in addition to that, there's recording. You know, you have to leave a certain percentage of bandwidth that is efficient for recording what happens, because you've got to be able to understand, or it's important to be able to understand what's happening with the car and what you're doing to fix it, so that you can logically kind of in the back of your mind fix it for the next lap, the next pit stop, or the next race. Really all of those things. You're trying to come up with scenarios of how can I make this car faster? Why can't I go faster in this corner? Which could be everything from the back end of the car is sliding, or simply the front end of the car is sliding, or it's not braking properly, or whatever. And then you've got to self-diagnose why you think that's happening, so that you can then either, if you're on the lower levels, if you're the driver, crew chief, and whatever, making all those changes, or on the higher level, you are communicating as efficiently as you can to your crew chief and or engineer, that then can think while that race is happening to come up with those answers. And you're doing that often in practice to try to have the best car for qualifying in the race, but you're still doing it in the race so that you can think, is there a way I'm driving that I can adjust to adapt to the handling of the car right now? And that's a whole nother portion of that bandwidth. So the psychological breakdown and aspect of this is gigantic. It's super important to being able to be composed and do one thing while thinking about another is really the epitome of race car driving.
Yeah. Like getting back to that, the risk management, you know, concept, it's like you're basically high speed information processing and looking for spots and judging, like, is it worth it at this moment, and doing that like many times all in a row and with all these different factors. Yeah. It seems high speed information processing and great risk management. Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing I've been curious about in racing and just a general interest in games and sports in general is when it comes to etiquette, how much etiquette is there besides like, don't hit another car, and where is the line between doing something that people would perceive as, you know, over the line and too aggressive versus just part of driving, you know, is it a firm line there, and how do you see that?
It's very much a gray area, and it is also dictated differently from series to series, sometimes even race to race, depending on the type of track. But like the IndyCar series is a series that has very little intentional contact, because the cars are a little more delicate. It's a little more dangerous. They interlock wheels. They've tried to build cars to be a little safer there. On the NASCAR side, you've got much sturdier, much safer cars, and the fans love the contact and the fight and whatnot. So you see a lot more of that there. It's a lot more widely accepted. And then in my case, on the sports car side, it's sort of a happy medium between the two, whereas there is definitely contact here and there. And each one of those three series cracks down on contact / rough driving / bad etiquette in different ways. And we have rules, it'll probably take too long to go into extreme detail on, about that sets up an essential etiquette around the rule. So in most cases, you can be extremely aggressive. And in most cases, actually in all cases, a little bit of contact is not a big deal, depending on how it's done. And then in some cases, a medium to heavy amount of contact is acceptable. But one of the reasons I love NASCAR is because it is 95% self-policing. If you wreck me coming into this corner, or shove me in the wall or free me up and knock me off the groove so that you can get by, you better watch out in the next corner. Mm-hmm. And if we end up balled up in the wall at the end of this thing and beating the heck out of each other, we'll learn eventually, or our bosses will fire us and fire somebody that does it a little more efficiently without causing that much damage. Mm-hmm. So it's, and I love that aspect of that. I mean, it works. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the Wild West. If everybody's got a handgun on their hip, there's a lot less people getting ready to shoot up a saloon. It's
self-adjusting system.
It's a self-adjusting system. Exactly. And it, you know, you're going to get some crazies here and there. And most of the time, those people either get weeded out through disqualifications, but more often they just get fired.
Mm-hmm. So, apart from, you know, too aggressive or dangerous, are there things that are just viewed as bad etiquette? So for example, say, you know, does anything go basically if you, like, say you're trying to block someone from passing? Is there pretty much anything, you know, you can do there is seen as good etiquette, you know, provided you're not like crashing into them or something?
So crashing into them is bad, although that happens on occasion when there's an argument over real estate. You know, again, we're often talking about trajectory adjustments. So when you're both going after the same piece of real estate that is 200 yards in front of you, because that's the optimal place to be in the middle of the corner, how you get there and coming from two different angles, it's like a merge lane, just really fast. You know, I'm sure everybody listening has been to a point where they've been merging onto an interstate or merging through a construction thing and arguing over who's side by side or who the late guy is coming off, cutting off the line of courteous people and whatnot. To simplify it again, because it gets super complicated and is almost on a case by case situation. There's essentially almost everywhere allowable blocking or defensive driving, as you would call it, is if you come out of a corner and you have a feel that I didn't come off this corner optimally. And the guy behind me has either been gaining or has been equal with me so much, or you have a sense of how he's driving that he probably got off that turn better than you. And now he has momentum to try to pass you. So if he was only 10 feet behind you and you had a little bit of a slide coming out of the corner at 100 miles an hour, maybe you move to the portion of the track that you know he wants to go to, or you move to the inside of the track because that would be the easiest way for him to get by. So you make his pass attempt much more challenging by putting him in the situation on the track that is not optimal for where he wants to be. Conversely, a late, you know, a chop is when the driver that's coming up to pass you has already basically broken the plane of your rear bumper. So he's already essentially has a portion of his car alongside you. If you then just chop across his nose or drive into his door, his or her door, that's where the etiquette part, that's where the illegality in most series comes into play, that you can't just swing your car all over the track and crash into anybody that you feel like. And that's a relatively widely known thing. You can push that issue to where, and that's where the gray area comes in. How close was he to starting that overlap before you chopped across in front of him and might not have hit him or her, but that driver had to lift out of the gas to keep from running into the back of you. And that's, so there's lots of gray area in that conversation. And right. You'll find as many situations as you can find and make up, and examples that you can use, you'll find that many opinions from people of what what should occur in that area.
So I like playing pool, and I had a friend who was really good at pool, and one of the things he taught me that really upped my game was thinking much more about where you're leaving the ball. You know, if you miss where you leave the cue ball for the next player, and making sure you don't leave them a shot, and focusing on more on that, like, made me much stronger because I just wasn't leaving shots for people. And I wonder, is there an analogy there where it's like a big part of the skill is like just blocking people from having a shot.
It's exactly the pool table analogy is exact. You need to be playing offense and defense at the same time, and you need to sacrifice one or the other if the net gain is going to be bigger. So, you know, if you're playing eight ball and you've got a shot at the eight ball, but if you miss that shot, it's going to most likely give the next guy a shot at the eight ball. Or if he's got a bunch of balls on the table, maybe it's not a bad time to move the eight ball to, you know, so you make contact and you move it to an area of the table that is less congested. If he's still got seven balls on the table and you're down to there, absolutely. So you can play a move, or conversely, maybe he or she is on the eight ball. Your opponent is on the eight ball and you've got three or four balls left on the table. Your offense, your initial thought is, man, I've got to get these last three balls in the pocket so I can, you know, even up the score here. But if I just hit this one lightly and leave this cue ball in a really bad spot, I essentially get a free turn because his whole goal is just going to be to touch the eight ball. He doesn't really have a shot. So yeah, absolutely. It's a great analogy.
So do you have any examples that come to mind, anecdotes about, you know, where you were really proud of, maybe like something where you got a read or did something really interesting with a specific driver and their patterns or use some cool reverse psychology? Any fun stories like that come to mind?
I mean, there's been a bunch over the years. Our next race is at a place called Sebring, Florida, which is smack dab in the middle of Florida. And a few years ago, I was running fourth on the last lap. And I knew the driver in front of me, super talented kid, but was also in the midst of trying to take over second, third, and fourth were nose to tail at the end of 12 hours. And I figure out he was faster than me at some points on the track, and I was faster than him at some points on the track. But I knew also that the second place car, where it was weak, was where I was strong. And if I could lay back a tiny bit, and where that driver was weak, he was also going to make the car behind him weak because he was smart enough to position himself in a way that would compromise the car behind. And if I could lay off in two corners before, I would have momentum coming to the point where normally we would all be checking up and waiting for the second place car to get on power. So I dropped back a little bit and was able to pull off a really nice crisscross on the last lap to pass the guy in third that the second place car made stumble. So again, you're thinking three-dimensionally here and with so many other variables, and you have to take into play. I would never normally slow down at one portion of the track thinking that I'm going to go fast, but I look in my rearview mirror, fourth place is way back. There's no threat for me from behind. I know that coming out of turn 16 at Sebring, we keep waiting on him. It's a very narrow portion of the track. We're not going to go too wide there. We have to try to set up. And a lot of times you'll drop back maybe 2 or 3 feet, something like that. I drop back 3 or 4 car lengths, knowing that most likely, especially on the last lap, they were going to be very conservative through the entry of the corner where there was less chance once he's down to the apex, the middle bottom of the corner, that he's going to get past. But it is super important for that driver to be on the gas and full throttle so that there's less of a chance of the driver behind him making a pass attempt. I was able to keep that momentum and you're timing it. You know, it much the same way you're keeping your eye on the ball from a pitcher throwing to the batter, much the same way you'd be jumping up to catch a pass in football. You happen to be the projectile instead of the thing. So you're planning your trajectory and your momentum to optimize at the right time. And that was a situation where we were able to take third place on the last lap, and they celebrate a podium in endurance sports car racing. So your top three get your champagne, get your trophies, get your bigger prize monies, whatnot. Certainly makes the bosses happy. So to go from fourth to third with like 100 feet left in the race, after 12 hours was something I was happy with, proud of. And especially when you can do that when you're really tired, when you're worn out and dehydrated, and it's 10 o'clock at night, it's dark, there's mud on your windshield. It's an absolute mess. It's extremely gratifying.
So I was talking to my my friend who does motorbike racing, and he was describing starting out doing it and how he would be intimidated by people who, you know, came up really fast and rev their engine really hard. And then he realized that he could do something similar to other racers who weren't that experienced, kind of like an intimidation thing. And he was describing some of these kinds of tricks. And I was wondering, are there, I know that these kind of like small tricks probably wouldn't come into play against skilled drivers, but I was curious, are there things like that come to mind that you would use against, you know, inexperienced drivers that would be like tricks of the trade against weaker drivers?
At the level that we're at, that's, the guys have been through most of those. There are times that you can try to shake a guy behind you by doing a little something. And it's all in the gray area of that etiquette that we talk about, of what's acceptable and what's a little bit of kind of old school dirty driving or whatnot. But I mean, it's all fun to do. I mean, you can track out of a corner, you know, on the asphalt and drop your right rear tire and throw up the dirt or the rocks or the mud or whatever's on the outside of that corner. If you can find a way to do it to where you don't impede your acceleration and speed, but you can distract them, it's one thing. There's also, just like in basketball, we use slower cars as picks. And if you're not heads up with that, you can really mess somebody up. If the following driver wasn't paying attention and they're like just way too much, you know, tunnel visioned onto your bumper and they don't see something coming, it's a big deal. So there's definitely a lot to do there. They're all extreme subtleties once you're at the top, but there's mental games and physical games that you can play even though you're strapped into a car.
How important is the pit crew having a synchrony and feeling, you know, knowing each other well, does that play a role in having a really tight pit crew?
So some races have pit stops and some don't. Most of the top professional races do. They are athletes and they are working together in a synchronized rhythm to get the pit stop done as efficiently and as fast as possible. So their relationship with themselves, not so much the driver, is most important. The relationship that the driver needs to have strong is with his engineer and or crew chief. They have different labels depending on what series you're running in, but it's the same thing. It's the driver that communicates to the crew chief or the engineer what the car is doing and what the car needs. And both of those things, what the car is doing, is super important, even more important, because it is the engineer's job to then deduce what the car needs, what changes you need to make to the setup. And you can have a relatively infinite amount of changes that you can do to a car, because every single change affects some other portion of that car. So your suspension, let's just take the front suspension. You've got a geometry of an upper and a lower wishbone, which changes the angle that the tire goes through as it leans onto the spring. The spring can be changed in rates of as little as 10 pounds, and that range could be a 1,000-pound range. You'll normally find something that you'll work in that will be as you develop that particular car that it tends to like, especially if you're using the same tire. But then you're also changing the shock, the ride height, the aerodynamic load, the tire pressures, the cambers, the toes. So everything that you're doing is trying to optimize essentially the contact patch where the rubber meets the road, as the saying goes. And to be able to, again, we're going to go back to that bandwidth. For me to drive at 100% and get the most out of the car through the corner from the break zone to where I turn it in, to where I get back on the gas, to where I track it out at the widest arc that I can, or on the stickiest portion of pavement. That while that's happening, while I'm getting all of that out of the car, I need to essentially be having that feeling, that seat of the pants feeling, and the visual on record. And as I come out of that corner, I need to essentially give myself a report card. Did I enter that as quick as I could? In the middle, did I pick up the gas as quick as I could? And did I use the most amount of road at the exit that I could to be efficient to unbind the car and get the most amount of exit speed? Now, and I'm simplifying this because you can really break it down into like 50 steps per corner. But I then have to think yes, yes, no, and come up with, okay, was I near the edge of the car, and does the car feel right? And if it doesn't feel right, what was that feeling that I can relate to my crew chief or engineer to help him make an adjustment on the car to soften a spring or to stiffen a shock or to increase an air pressure or to lean the tire in a little bit more? And that is a super important relationship. That is a super, super important technique to understand within yourself and be able to accomplish, to be able to communicate like that. And then in addition to that, the engineer being able to understand your language. So you can both be speaking English, but if your descriptions and your understanding of that description are not in cue, he's going to make a change that isn't exactly how you were able, what you need in that car. And so the better you understand each other and the better you can relate past circumstances, the more optimal you're going to be at setting that car up. So we don't have a nonstop amount of practice time. In a short amount of, we get X amount of practice, let's call it 30 minutes. And in that time, if I can do two laps, come in, make a change, do two laps, come in, make a change, do two laps, come in and make a change, I've got three changes that got me closer to where I think the car needs to be perfect. If I need longer to understand what's happening with the car, which is what most new drivers do, that it takes them a while to essentially filter out the white noise, is how I'll put it. There's so many channels of information coming into you, and through vibration, through essentially like an internal G meter in so many different axes, that you need to filter out the stuff that's not important and be able to zone in on the things that are important. And so there is a huge bit of focused thinking that has to go on while you're doing something extremely physically and mentally taxing. You know, the mental taxing comes from, if I make a mistake at the edge, I can wreck this $100, $200, $300, $400, $500,000 car, depending on what you're doing. So there's stress that comes with that. And then there's a focus on your ability to be precise. And when I say precise, I don't mean within like a foot. I mean within like an inch of where you want that tread pattern on the car. So understanding your car's boundaries the way you would understand yourself running down a hallway between people, you need to be able to do that exact thing with the car. It's got to be, you know, it sounds cheesy, but to be one with, and to be able to do all of that and still be on record, and then also have the prowess to communicate those feelings, eliminate that white noise, and filter out the things you don't need, and be able to communicate the essential and most important things to your engineer. That relationship is of the utmost importance.
So many factors. Yeah, it's amazing, like you said, that a long race can be that close when you consider all those factors too. Yeah. So I have to ask you about the veganism, because I'm vegan also. So I'm curious. That's definitely not something most people would probably associate with a professional race car driver, probably especially in America. And I'm curious, do you get a lot of grief or you know, friendly teasing for that? How respectful are the fellow drivers or people in the industry?
Nonstop, buddy. I am definitely in the auto racing industry, especially on the NASCAR side, a minority there. One of the first for sure, still one of the few, but there are a handful that are jumping on board. They're seeing that in a lot of the sports that I do, whether it's the mountain biking or the MMA or the skateboarding or the auto racing, that, you know, I'm almost 50. I'm not far from 50. And you know, physically,
you're still alive.
I mean, yeah, right. Well, one, I've been vegetarian for nearly 20 years and then vegan for nearly 15 now. So the protein, the myth of the protein deficiency for any human is busted. If you eat right, you can have unhealthy carnivores and herbivores that just eat McDonald's all day, and those, you know, the healthier meat eaters will be like, oh, they're eating junk, but then they'll make the same example of the vegan that's just a hippie that eats French fries and potato chips all day, and you can think about it. Yeah. You can eat poorly in any diet. And so we don't want to use the bottom of the barrel on either of those sides as examples of what can or should happen. You want to use the elites that are doing it right on each side. And I'm not saying that you can't be big and strong and healthy and run fast or build big muscles eating meat. My goal is to be able to be as good or if not better being plant-based, and that for me is an ethical thing, because I am obviously, with all the things that I do in my life, very performance oriented. So I don't want to give up that advantage. And I was actually very concerned about it when I went vegetarian first. I waited until my last race of the season so that I would have the entire winter to train and push myself and see if this protein deficiency that all of these idiots that were uneducated on what was going to happen to me in the 2 or 3 months that I had between our 9 month race season were going to come true. And it was an amazing surprise and bonus. You know, I went for ethical reasons and was humbly surprised by how much better I got. Not only, vanity reasons, my skin was so much clearer minus the dairy and stuff like that. But like, I do a 10K run that I would do like three times a week. After only 3-4 weeks on when I went veg, I beat my best 10K time. I had a magnetic notepad on my refrigerator, and I would put each 10K time on there, and I would pages and pages of that. And it was a relatively consistent time. On a really hot day, maybe it's slower, or on a rainy day, it might be slower, but it was almost always at about a 50 to a 51 minute 10K. And I would be taking 3 seconds, 10 seconds, whatever. By the time I started the next season, I was in like a 47 minute 10K. And that had been after years of being at like a 50 minute 10K. Running at that heart rate. You know, I never ran a 10K for the time. I ran it at the heart rate. So I was getting a 3 minutes off of a 10K at that pace. So it's not 50 minutes isn't a super fast 10K by any means. You know, it's not any world challenging record or anything. But like, for what I'm doing it for, the cardio aspect was okay. But to chop 3 minutes of that off is a massive percentage of that time. It's like a 6 or 7% gain on my physical ability, and that was everything I needed to know right there. And I still wasn't good at, again, this is 20 years ago, I didn't have every app in the world telling me what was the right thing to eat, and I hadn't educated myself well enough yet, and my palate hadn't adapted yet to where I was craving all of the right foods. And then as I did that, it just got better and better and better. And again, like I said, I was in very good shape at 28. Now I'm 48 and then some, and in as good or better shape than I've ever been.
Yeah, I was curious to ask about it, because I was looking at your Twitter, and I saw a fellow racer, I think kind of my, it was a friendly thing where he was like, typical response from a a militant vegan anarchist or something. And it just made me think you must get this kind of mocking, you know, kind of friendly banter from people. Here's the vegan, but I it must be a interesting aspect of your career, I'm sure.
It is, because some people, you know, I have friends that tease and I tease back and whatnot. But then, like, again, if you've got any sort of social media following like that, you're going to get the typical human range of close friends to associates to
trolls.
So all the way to the bottom is just the scum of the earth that found an iPhone somehow and would, And those people, you filter out the haters, and you're going to get that nonstop. I mean, if there's any sort of eyeballs on you, you're going to get that, and you just have to understand that there's such a small part of the population, and they're not going anywhere. And that even though that gene pool might be tainted, it's part of the process and part of the deal, unfortunately. And I'm getting my message across to many more people that. One of the coolest things that can happen to me is someone that comes up to me at a racetrack that has heard some of my messages, my pleas for essentially kindness, and have reviewed what they do in life and on the vegan side, and tell me that they've made a change like that. And that's the coolest thing that can happen. That makes me so much more than just someone that's a race fan or into this that say, hey, I listened to you and it was annoying at first. And then I was a little open-minded about it and saw what you're saying about how animals are treated, and just did my own. I looked into it and I learned and I found out the facts, and it inspired me enough to go. And that's honestly the coolest thing that can happen from my entire life.
That was a talk with Andy Lally, who's a member of Magnus Racing. You can follow Andy on Twitter at Andy Lally, that's Andy, LALLY, or on Instagram at Andy Lally Racing. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. If you enjoyed this episode, just a heads up that I've got quite a few episodes about various sports and games in the back catalog. If you like this podcast, please consider signing up for the premium membership, which you can do on my site, behavior-podcast.com. Or maybe share it with your friends and family. Okay, thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.